like chemicals, don't like killing. Look in your kitchen, the story there's chilling. Plant food, Windex, mouse bait too. Mr. Clean, easy off, even pet shampoo. You wanna be a hypocrite? Just forget to have the shit. We feed you.
Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 26 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Where We Are with Wireworms, about how Eastern Washington wheat farmers' primary scourge just a few years ago appears to be coming under control, thanks in part to the efforts of the Washington Grain Commission. For those of you listening who might not be familiar with wireworms, a primer is in order. Wireworms are the larval stage of the click beetle, which for all intents and purposes looks like a typical beetle, a statement that will no doubt cause anguish among beetle researchers, given that there are approximately 350,000 different species of beetles on Earth. In fact, beetles account for 25% of all known life forms on the planet. Within those hundreds of thousands of beetles, there were, at last count, nearly 900 species of click beetles. Only around 100 of those, however, have been matched with their larval, i.e., wireworm form. The click beetle lays anywhere from 50 to 350 eggs at a time. After hatching, wireworms live in the soil anywhere from a couple of years to 5 years before becoming a mature click beetle and flying away to find a mate and repeating the process with a new generation. Until 2006 and for the 40 years previous, wireworms in eastern Washington were taken care of by a chemical called lindane. As inexpensive as it was effective, lindane allowed farmers to press cruise control as far as dealing with wireworms. Unfortunately, the scientific community also pressed cruise control, moving their efforts to solve pest issues without solutions. Enter the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA started warning the industry in the early 2000s that lindane's registration wouldn't be renewed owing to carcinogenic, i.e., cancer-causing concerns. Farmers stopped using the chemical in 2006. It was a couple of years later before they began to see odd patches in their fields. Aaron Esser, WSU Extension Regional Agronomist for Wheat Production based in Ritzville, was one of the first in the region to figure out the enormity of the problem. He remembers the exact day his wireworm program started.
My program started probably, I'm going to say it was June 14th, 2008. That was the year I had two different on-farm trials in, come up over the hill and looked at a trial with which at the time was a rate of Gaucho, no, it was Cruiser, that we had never used before. Two, three times the rate that farmers were traditionally using, even more than that. And we had severe wireworm damage in those plots as well. So at that stage, I realized we had something a lot bigger going on. And a lot of farmers before 2008 were misdiagnosing the damage as weed pressure or wild oats, you know, something else.
The Washington Grain Commission understood nearly as quickly as Esser the severity of the problem and in 2011 awarded the $1.5 million Distinguished Professorship to Washington State University entomologist Keith Pike to investigate the pest. At that time, there were 4 known species of wireworm in eastern Washington. With the approximately $60,000 a year generated by the Distinguished Professorship, by 2016, scientists in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana had identified 14 wireworm species, mapped their locations throughout the Northwest, established relative levels of virulence among the most prominent types, tested dozens of chemical compounds against them, and helped guide the industry toward higher seed treatment thresholds. Esser, who works on the applied side of wheat research, has focused much of his extension efforts on helping farmers avoid the devastation caused by wireworms. He and I spoke in the storage shed at the Wilkie Farm near Davenport, where he was preparing for an upcoming field day. I asked if he was happy with the progress made over the last 9 years.
from where I started and back in 2008 to what we know today, I think it is really tremendous. We have a better grasp on wireworm overall, what the damage looks like. And half the issue is trying to get farmers to even make them more aware and properly diagnose in their fieldmen wireworm damage. We've since increased the rates of the neonics to something that can be more suppressive for wireworms. And in some instances, with certain rates and certain species, we can get into where we do increase the mortality of wireworms. So I think using those increased rates has really helped over time.
You have said in the past that these chemicals do not kill wireworms. They only distress them. They only deter them a bit. This is a difference from what you initially said many years ago now.
Yeah. And then we got the numbers in. You know, we see reduced populations. I'm assuming it's mortality, but the portion of the study didn't specifically look at counting dead wireworms, but there's definitely less wireworms the following year, significantly less wireworms the following year, so I'm assuming they were dead.
Although it's too soon to declare victory over wireworms, Esser believes one of the reasons so much progress has been made so quickly is the result of the WGC funding.
Distinguished Chair did its job. It tackled an issue that really what we didn't have the funding and stuff to address it, and a team got put together led by Dr. David Crowder, started with Keith Pike, and then myself and our graduate student, Ivan, a PhD student, and we really ramped up. We learned a lot more about the species and what we were doing along with some of their trials. So that went a long way to just learning a lot more about what we're dealing with, the life cycle, the species, how these species react differently to different chemistries. It was tremendous. It did its job.
Esser does a pretty good job himself of being able to pronounce the chemical names of the various compounds that are used in seed treatments. But he even stumbles over the lengthy scientific words, so I'm not about to try. I ask him to list the three neonic chemicals available to farmers by brand name.
Commercially available, you have Nipset Inside, you have Gaucho, and you have Cruiser. Those are the three primary insecticides that farmers use for wireworm control as a seed treatment. I call them Ford Dodge Chevys. If you have a Ford dealership in town, there's going to be a dominance of Fords running across the community. If you have a Dodge dealership, there's a dominant amount of Dodge. So the seed dealers are the ones who really make a lot of those decisions. When you look at the wireworm populations and species, each species reacts a little bit different to that. The Cruiser with 1 ounce, I've documented significant decrease in wireworm populations following 1 ounce of Cruiser with Infiscatus. I haven't seen the same results with Californicus, but with 2 ounces of Gaucho, I can reduce the wireworm population on both species by upwards of 50-60%.
Are you concerned at all about losing the neonics, given the concern over bee deaths?
I'm concerned about losing the neonics, of course, and of course it relates to bee death, I'm just hope the science prevails. We don't have too many bees in our wheat field out here. There's, you know, all the years I've done my wireworm studies with these neonics, I've worked with all these growers use neonics, and there's not too many dead bees around. There's no dead bees around here. When neonics were first introduced in this area, they were brought in on canola. You won't find a canola crop. The canola out here is treated with a neonic. Okay, it was brought in, they put it on canola for flea beetle control, and they use it for aphid control in canola. But any beekeeper will drive miles upon miles to get his bees next to a canola field. If it was that strong of link, it would have been made a long time ago. That strong of link hasn't been made, and some studies will say yes it does, some say yes or no it doesn't, and a lot of us just trying to pair up, yes, it harms bees, but you still got to get the dose, the right rate, the right dose in contact with the bees. And in our situation where we're using this chemistry, it's just not, those just don't line up.
As I recall, it was a really dry 2014 and 2015. And in 2014, you saw the wireworms being a problem in winter wheat rather than spring wheat. I guess my question is what are they a problem in, winter or spring wheat?
They're predominantly more of a larger issue in spring wheat crops, but they're also an issue in winter wheat crops. I've seen many fields that had severe damage because of wireworms in them. They're not necessarily immune just because you're raising winter wheat. Winter wheat has a tendency to withstand some more of the damage. The damage happens in the spring of year. So you already have a 3, 4, 5 leaf tillered winter wheat. And so it can withstand some of the damage. You'll lose a tiller or two, but you really don't lose the whole plant necessarily. On spring wheat, you have a 2-leaf, 1-leaf spring wheat, and it'll take out the whole plant. And so therefore, it's a little bit more obvious damage in the spring wheat crop. You end up with bigger patches. But there's been growers who've experienced severe damage in winter wheat as well.
Although 14 click beetle species have been identified, Esser says not all of them are damaging.
There's three species that were predominantly economically damaging here in the Pacific Northwest. Californicus, Infiscatus, and the dryland species that we see down into the Ritzville, into the Bickleton area. Lonosum pruniensis.
Now, farmers are doing a lot of new things on their farms that they weren't doing 10 years ago. Are they identifying the species of wireworm?
Probably not to the degree I would like them to, and the degree I think they should be. But they are taking a lot more active, aggressive approach early on. And when you look at certain regions have certain species, so, you know, up in this area up around Wilbur, the dominant species is Infiscatus. From Reardon to Davenport, we have a lot more Californicus. So those two species are treated a little bit different, but across that area, it can be one species will usually dominate an area. But it's not uncommon to find mixed species.
And if farmers have a species that isn't very damaging, can they ignore it?
No, because it will become damaging. Like Infiscatus versus Californicus is what we primarily find here in the Palouse. Infiscatus will do half the damage of one Californicus almost per se. You know, it'll eat twice as much, do twice as much damage. But I've seen fields from Wilbur all the way down to Mokonema that were completely destroyed because of Infiscatus populations. It just takes more per acre or more per trap to cause damage.
Have we become more educated in terms of the lifestyle of the click beetle that lays the eggs, the wireworm eggs, and how long those worms that hatch out of the eggs stay in the soil, and when they emerge to become click beetles themselves?
We probably don't know as much about the click beetles. I mean, we really haven't focused a lot on that just because it's such a hard target to go after, just how they emerge from the soil and the duration. It really would be hard to time some sort of treatment or something to really go after a click beetle. And if you control the click beetle, you still have the wireworm population out there that may be out there for 3, 4, 5, upwards of 10 years. So by simply controlling the click beetle 1 year on your farm, if your neighbor doesn't control it, you still have wireworm pressure and the click beetle still move. So we really haven't targeted the click beetles that much. For that, it's going to take a lot more pheromone trapping and they're looking at some of that up in Canada and in Europe, but we really don't have the pheromones developed yet for the species that we have here in the Pacific Northwest.
So what's the latest on crop rotations? At one time, there were some articles that different crop rotations affected the populations of wireworms in the soil. Where are we with regard to crop rotations?
You know, just from the general agronomic standpoint, crop rotation is always a benefit from the wireworm standpoint. When you look at it, just because you put in a mustard crop or a canola crop or a pea crop doesn't mean you don't have wireworm pressure. But in some instances, I think you'll see a decrease in wireworm population over time. Wireworms will stay in the soil 3, 4, 5 years. They can live off organic matter. So simply switching up a crop won't necessarily do it. But where it does have a benefit is when they hatch in the spring, the click beetle may move away and find a cereal grain field to go lay eggs in. Okay, you haven't done anything with the wireworm population, but the egg laying, you forced her to go somewhere else to lay eggs. So that, long term, can be a benefit down the road. So that's where some of the crop rotation can come into it.
What about summer fallow? Do summer fallow farmers have to worry as much as annual croppers about wireworms?
Well, up here in the with Californicus and Infiscatus, one of the things we found with regarding both species is incorporating summer fallow winter wheat into a rotation versus continuous spring cropping, you reduce your wireworm population by upwards of 50%. And that could come down to just simply egg laying every other year versus egg laying every year. When you look at the Solanus and Prunus, that dryland species, one of the reasons I think it may have a longer life cycle is because of the winter wheat fallow. You know, it can live upwards of 10 years, where Californicus and Infiscatus are up to, you know, 4 or 5 years. Well, that may be a part of it is that every other year thing in the fallow, summer fallow region where they kind of like.
Now, the company Alba was hoping to get a Section 18 on a chemical that didn't go anywhere. I believe that that included the addition of fipronil. Where does that stand now? Is there any chance of getting a registration for fipronil?
Any of the numbers you look at with fipronil, one of the advantages of it is it does significantly reduces, almost eliminates the population of wireworms in the soil. So it'd be a tremendous chemical to get our hands on to utilize in our crop rotations to really get rid of this issue so it can move on and focus on something else. Getting it available, you know as well as I do, it still has baggage attached to it. So when the EPA doesn't like it, it's going to be a tough sell to get it labeled.
For the record, the Washington Grain Commission submitted a Section 18 emergency exemption for use of fipronil to control wireworms in wheat to the Washington State Department of Agriculture in early 2016. Because the EPA indicated it had concerns with occupational risk exposure, after consulting with all cooperating partners, the WGC withdrew the application rather than risk rejection, which would have made resubmission more difficult. I ask Esser if he were a farmer with 3,500 acres of wheat, what sort of management advice he'd be following, given all that he's learned about wireworms over the last 9 years.
It all starts with understanding the population across that 3,500 acres of what I have and what the cropping history has been, and understanding the population across the managed Wilkie farm where we're at today. And I put wireworm traps out each and every year at the same spots to monitor populations, and then I adjust my wireworm rates accordingly on what my population is showing. Not only this year's population, but in plot this 25 acres over here, what are we looking at? Is a population, wireworm population, on the increase? Is it on the decrease? Or what's going on with it, monitoring that way? And then I adjust my chemistries accordingly and my crop rotation. If I have a bad infestation in a certain area, I'd make a point to just seed it last. And if I'm seeding 70 pounds an acre, I'm going to seed maybe 85 pounds an acre. If I'm putting on 1 ounce of imidacloprid across the whole field, I may get a load with 2 ounces of imidacloprid. So just by going up in the rate, increasing the seeding rate, and delaying the seeding on that piece, I think we'll go a long way to helping to enhance your overall wireworm control.
On this made-up 3,500-acre farm, how much sampling has to go on?
I mean, that's been my focus, is trying to get growers to do a little bit more of that. And when you look at the cost of these insecticides, I think it's easier anymore for a grower just to say, well, I saw some damage out there, I'm going to put on 2 ounces instead of 1 ounce. And they really haven't gone to the degree of trapping I'd like them to really understand what they have for populations out there. But they still have that increased awareness, which is a good benefit.
So on a 3,500 acre farm, how many traps would you like to see?
You know, per field, I like to, 10 traps per field. If it's a 600 acre field, I'd like to throw 10 traps out there and just see what I have.
Where are we going at this point? Here we are, it's 2017. Next year it'll be 10 years since you saw that field and realized that wireworms were a big problem. What's happening in the future?
Today that field is extremely clean where the wireworm pressure was at, so that's a good thing. The farmer's done a great job of incorporating some fallow into it, less continuous crop, and he's done some other things cropping-wise, increasing his rates of neonics that really have minimized it. Moving forward, I hope to, we're going to have more tools in our toolbox to control wireworms, whether it's a biological or some different chemistries hopefully coming down the line that will be more effective on wireworms and hopefully make it a little bit more like the old days with lindane where, you know, we have the next generation of farmers can grow up without worrying about a wireworm population.
Wouldn't that be great? For now, however, farmers have to largely rely on neonicotinoids, and as any farmer knows, depending on a single solution can be dangerous. And I'm not just talking about resistance. In Europe, environmentalists and bee activists have already pushed for regulations curtailing neonicotinoid use, and there is a loud debate in this country about doing the same. I'm posting 4 articles on our Washington Grain Commission Facebook page that I've written for Wheat Life since 2012. It was interesting for me to read them over again to understand the evolution of wireworm knowledge over a relatively short period. Thanks to the Washington Grain Commission's kickstart, researchers have subsequently leveraged grants from the federal government to continue their efforts. That's it for episode 26, or what I'm calling Where We Are with Wireworms. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Scott Yates, hoping you'll tune in again for another episode of Weed All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.